At a time when investors are confronted with market volatility and a variety of challenges fueled by the uncertainty of inflation, unsettled geopolitical tensions, and economic pressures, Luke Guerrero stands ready to take your finance and investment questions and share his unbiased answers. InvestTalk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. The clarity for your path forward starts now. Here is KPP Financial Portfolio Manager, Luke Guerrero.
Good afternoon, fellow investors, and welcome back to InvestTalk. Today is Tuesday, April 23rd, 2024. And my name is Luke Guerrero, and I'm excited to be your guide over this next hour along your investing journey. Now, in order to become better educated investors, remember that is our goal here every day, we'll talk about some stories that I found interesting today, some topics that'll be important for when you decide how you want to invest within your own portfolio. But most importantly, we'll hear from you. 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, our phone lines are open at 888-99-CHART, but I particularly love to hear from you all live. So hopefully we hear from a couple of you today, just like we did yesterday, over this next hour. That being said, we'll talk about the market performance and run down the show topics a little later on, but right after we answer our first caller question now.
Hi, Stephen Justin. I'm interested in a stock, CRISPR Therapeutics. That's C for Charlie, R for Romeo, S for Sierra, P for Peter, CRSP. And I just wondered what an ideal entry price for this stock would be. Thanks very much. Bye.
So CRISPR Therapeutics is a company that was founded, I believe, in 2013. Yeah, in October of 2013. And it's a gene editing company. And in its entire history, I don't believe it's made a single dollar of profit. Oh, it looks like it did in 2021. But other than that, its profitability has been pretty negative. So in 2020, it didn't make money. In 2021, it made a little bit. Then it oscillated back towards not making money the past couple years. Not supposed to make any money this year. Not supposed to make any money next year. On top of that, the revenue growth, all over the place. They go from having revenue to really not having revenue. And that's because this is one of the most pie-in-the-sky companies that you could possibly think of. And in a time when interest rates were low, historically low, it did well because capital was free. But as we've said, we're headed into a more inflationary period where rates are not going back to where they were before. Because of that, companies like this that don't really generate any profits at all whatsoever are not the type of things that you want to be investing in. It's a great idea. It certainly is one of those ideas of the future that has been touted for about a decade now. But as my mom liked to say, the proof is in the pudding, and there is not a lot of pudding, not a lot of profits here. So I would not be throwing my money in this company right now. Thanks for the call. Now, we've got a lot of ground to cover over the next 45 minutes or so, and here is some of what I have planned, time permitting. My main focus point concerns this question. You can make IRA contributions at any age, but should you? Traditional IRA contributions after RMD age may make sense, but it really depends on your tax situation. Now, in order to understand this, we'll talk a little bit about IRA withdrawals in retirement, retirement planning generally, and also traditional IRAs. We'll also talk about U.S. home sales. New data came out today about the month of March. And what did it say about new family home sales, building construction starts, and really the housing market broadly? We'll also talk about U.S. shale output and how over the past decade or so, the U.S. has really put itself in a position where it can shelter America from the next oil price surge. So we'll talk about how the U.S. shale industry has grown and how that's beneficial for the U.S. economically and diplomatically. Should we have time at the end of the show, we'll also talk about investors who are now really pricing in the chance of not only not a rate cut this year, but perhaps a rate increase over the next 12 months. So we'll talk about that at the end of the show, should we have some time. And of course, we'll also answer some questions that came into the Voice Bank earlier, one on WNC, Wabash National Corp, and SILJ, which is the Amplify Junior Silver Miners ETF. And of course, hopefully you call and talk to me at 888-99-CHART anytime over this next hour. Let's talk about the market today. U.S. stocks were mostly higher today, really near best levels that they traded at throughout the entire day. The S&P continued its bounce off of last week's significant decline. Momentum, growth, long duration, small caps were all big beneficiaries today. Big tech was higher yet again, as were semis, med tech, software. Let's see who did poorly today. Industrial metals did poorly today. Airlines, beverages did poorly today. And most notably, in my opinion, the $69 billion two-year note auction was actually met with some pretty solid demand today. Gold finished down again, maybe as a result of that, and crude oil ended up almost 2%. And so this bounce really continued today after yesterday's bounce as well, with the help of lower rates and a weaker dollar in the wake of this softer flash PMI data. Remember, we're in a place right now where essentially bad news is good news, because if there's any hint of deterioration economically, that means maybe we're in line for more rate cuts down the line. So that PMI data coming in under consensus was helpful to the market as well. Also, you know, an overall reduction in orders for the first time in 10 months. And on the geopolitical front, news that the U.S. is reportedly drafting sanctions that could cut some Chinese banks from global financial system due to support for Russia. Looking ahead to the rest of the week, we got some big tech earnings coming in, as well as core PCE inflation. Those are really the big catalysts for stocks in the next few days. Now we're going into a short break, and on the other side, I'll tackle your finance and investment questions. Please remember that you can call anytime and leave your questions on the InvestTalk voice bank, 888-99-CHART.
In today's world, a variety of factors are affecting the stock markets. Serious investors know building a secure financial future requires hard work and determination. That's why now, more than ever, when it comes to the planning, execution, and maintenance of your portfolio, you need InvestTalk. With total downloads surpassing 50 million, each InvestTalk podcast should be one of your key financial planning and educational tools. InvestTalk is a free download, and hosts Justin Klein and Steve Peasley stand ready to provide their unbiased guidance and professional analysis developed from real-time data research and years of investing experience. 24/7, rain or shine, during smooth sailing or on rough weather days, the InvestTalk listener line is open and waiting for your questions. You set the agenda. Don't forget to call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Got finance and investment questions, and Luke Guerrero is here taking your calls live. InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
I asked you to call in and you did not disappoint. Mike from Texas, you had a question about SBSI. Do you own it, or are you looking to buy it?
Hey, Luke. I currently own it, and about 3 weeks ago, Justin had brought up one of my previous calls about this company that I called in about maybe about 2 years ago. And, anyways, it's a regional bank, and it's definitely gone downhill. I'm about probably about 18% down now. And anyways, I was just curious if I was to get out of it. I was looking at possibly looking into an ETF, two different ETFs. I'm looking at the Fidelity Consumer Staples Index, which is ticker FSTA, or the Fidelity Real Estate ETF, which is ticker FREL. And I was just kind of curious on your thoughts as far as those ETFs. Life is super crazy, and I don't have the time to sit down and, you know, research the companies as I did a couple of years ago. So I was looking more as to some passive ETFs.
Yeah, no, that's completely understandable. I think for most people being involved in their 9-to-5 job, as well as their family life, it kind of becomes difficult to keep track of companies. And so SBSI, for those of you who are not aware, is Southside Bankshares, Inc., and it is a regional bank. I think, honestly, we'll talk about this hopefully if we have time at the end of the show about how now there is some inclination from the markets that something that we've been saying for some time, that maybe rates can even go higher. And one of the problems with the regional banks is they had a lot of duration risk. And so what you could see is you could see a continued slide within those regional banks that aren't as protected as some of those larger banks. So I think that it probably does make sense, given the macro environment, that you may want to sell this. And so thinking about those two other ETFs, they are relatively inexpensive ETFs, broadly diversified, one within consumer staples, the other within REITs. I would say between those two, given the macro environment, I would probably be more inclined to lean towards consumer staples. Again, it's kind of difficult to say without knowing the totality of your portfolio. But for the same reason that regional banks may do poorly over the next 6 months, REITs may slip as well. If the reality, you know, comes down the pike and we actually do continue to raise rates, that could be bad for REITs, bad for regional banks. So looking at both of those, I think they're both fine, broadly diversified ETFs. But given the market dynamics, I would probably lean towards the consumer staples one.
All right, man. Well, I appreciate you and thanks for your time.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Now let's keep things moving and swing back to the InvestTalk Voice Bank for a question from a listener in North Carolina.
Hi there. This is Emil Naslund from Charlotte, North Carolina. A few weeks ago, you talked about a company called Old Dominion, a freight company, as a good investment and a good, well-run company. I have thoughts about another company in that same general industry or adjacent to it. Would be Wabash National. They supply trailers to the trucking industry, and they appear to me, at least, as a very well-run company as well. So I'll be interested in what your thoughts are from that company. Again, that is Wabash National. Thank you.
So Wabash National Corp, WNC, engages in the design and manufacture of semi-trailers, truck bodies, and specialized commercial vehicles. Now, you know, one thing it has that, or rather something it doesn't have that Old Dominion did was significant growth. So over the past 5 years, the five-year annualized growth rate is about 2.3%, and margins have been pretty steady. There were some odd revenues that came in, some non-stable revenues that came in that pushed up margins in 2023, but looks like they're coming back to down to earth at about 4.6% is what net margins is projected to be this year. From a debt perspective, it's minimal debt, $429 million on a $1.1 billion company, and cash flow's improving and profits are relatively stable. Now, it's been pretty strong over the past year and a half. Its relative strength is certainly up there compared to other companies, but it's dipped off a little bit since mid-March. One thing that strikes me, although their dividend is pretty consistent, is that it currently sits at about 16.8% short interest. So the market is really seeing this as something that is relatively overpriced. From a price-to-book perspective, it's 2.1. Nothing crazy. Price-to-earnings is 11.1. Nothing too crazy. Frankly, I don't see a lot of upside with this company, given its lack of growth over the past couple years, and that growth has actually kind of tapered off from 2022 to 2023, and they're supposed to have less revenue than they did last year. So, you know, overall, I think there are better places where you could put your capital. I would probably pass on this one, especially given how much short interest is out there. Thanks for the call. Now, I hope you've been telling your friends that our InvestTalk audio podcast is also posted in video on our YouTube channel. And it seems that every day now we receive finance and investment questions from the comment section of our InvestTalk YouTube. Here's one that came in recently. It says, "Hey, Luke or Justin, I was wondering if you could take a look at TFII. I've owned it since April 2020, and I'm wondering if I should close the position. I've taken profits, and it's only about 2% of my portfolio." So taking a look at TFII, that would be TFI International Incorporated, and it is a freight transportation and logistics service company that is headquartered in Canada. So let's take a look at their geographical revenue here. It looks like 34% comes from Canada and 66% comes from the United States. Well, if we're talking about where economic growth is supposed to be focused over the next year, within G7 countries, that's pretty much the United States and Canada. So that's a good thing for this company. It also looks like it's had good growth. Annualized growth rate of 14.7% over the past 5 years. That tapered off from 2022 into 2023, but there is some supply chain disruptions, and they're supposed to grow as well this year. What about relative valuation? Price to earnings, about 18.3. Nothing too crazy. Its price to book is about 4, so maybe a little bit expensive, but overall, I think I like this company. It's got good growth. It's focusing its operations in two countries that are expected to have outsized economic growth relative to the rest of the world. And it looks like a pretty well-run business that has minimal debt. Let me check their debt loads real quick on this other system here. Because on here, I'm seeing their long-term debt is about $2 billion on a $19 billion, $17 billion market cap company. And yeah, so very minimal debt. They're not overly leveraged. Their earnings have been upgraded. Their cash flow is good. Profitability is good. I don't see any reason to sell this company. Thanks for the call. This is Invest Talk now with more than 58.5 million downloads. And coming up, we'll dig into my main focus point. But right now, we're heading into a short break. So give us a call at 888-99-CHART.
Every investor is working to build a secure financial future. The more you learn about how the market works, the better your chances for success. InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
My main focus point concerns this question. You can make IRA contributions at any age, but should you? Traditional IRA contributions after RMD age may make sense, but it really depends on your tax situation. So in order to talk about this topic, what you need to understand is how new legislation affected IRA withdrawals in retirement and how important retirement planning is, especially if you have a traditional IRA now. So a less discussed, I would say, yet vital topic from the Secure Act of 2019 is that this legislation revamped, in many ways, our retirement system. And that's because there's a key provision, which I think hasn't been talked about enough. And that provision gives the ability for older Americans to continue contributing to their traditional IRAs beyond the age of 73, provided that they have earned income. Now, before this change, no money was allowed in after the RMD age, the required minimum distribution age. Now, why does this matter? Well, the fact is, Americans are generally working longer. Nearly twice as many people over the age of 65 are employed today as were employed in 1988. And it's often out of financial necessity rather than just because you like working, due to increased life expectancy and a wholesale shift away from defined benefit plans towards defined contribution plans. Pensions are generally gone now. So the big question is, should older workers still contribute to their IRAs, even if they're drawing them down? Now, on one hand, making additional contributions can make sense. It helps to reduce your taxable income through deductions. But for many people, Roth IRAs might be the better choice. Unlike traditional IRAs, Roths don't have RMDs, which means you can grow them tax-free indefinitely, which can be particularly appealing to you if you're planning to leave your assets to heirs. And even though we can now continue contributing to traditional IRAs, regardless of age, there are still rules you have to follow. The first, I already mentioned, you must have earned income at least equal to your contribution amount. Secondarily, there are income limits which might restrict your ability to make deductible contributions to a traditional IRA. Now, if you're catching up on your retirement, your retirement savings, and expect to be in a lower tax bracket in the future, traditional contributions could offer some valuable tax breaks. And for those earning too much to contribute directly to a Roth, the backdoor Roth IRA route, which means you're contributing to a traditional IRA, then converting it to a Roth, may be a good option. But ultimately, the decision to contribute to an IRA, whether traditional or even Roth, involves weighing the benefits of tax-deferred growth against your current and future financial needs. Each option has its merits, but also has its limitations. And your personal financial situation will definitely dictate which approach is best for you. So given this level of complexity, in my opinion, it's wise to consult with a financial planner, financial professional like ourselves or whoever you use, and they can help tailor a strategy that best meets your retirement goals given your financial situation. Now let's shift on back and talk about another question which came in from our YouTube channel, this one, about ASML. It says, what would be your entry price for ASML? Now, ASML is ASML Holdings, and it is a semiconductor company. And like many semiconductor companies, it has had a big year, up 43%. But that big year has also been matched generally with its sales growth. From 2018 until 2023, they've had a five-year annualized sales growth rate of about 20%. And so that kind of tapered off over the past year, but it's still pretty significant growth. Now, they are a $328 million market cap company, so relatively small. And $343 billion market cap company, with about $5 billion in debt. So their debt levels are pretty modest. And over the past 4 years, they've been buying back shares on a pretty significant basis. Their cash flow is decreasing, however, as is their profitability, and the relative strength has started to take a turn, as did some of the big tech names in the past couple days. They had a pretty bad week last week. The thing that really strikes you about this, its forward-looking price earnings is 38. Its forward-looking price to book is 23.4. That means that they would have to sustain this 20% annualized growth rate for a very long time in order to justify these valuations. I've said it before, I'll say it again, it's not just about buying good businesses, it's about buying good businesses at fair prices. So honestly, I would probably wait until this thing comes back down to 600. I think it's got a lot of room on the downside, because could it go up? Of course it could continue to go up. I don't know what the future is going to look like. But investing is just as much about risk as it is about return. And at elevated valuations like this, there's a lot more risk than return, in my opinion. On the next Invest Talk, we'll look into the story behind this question. Should you pay off your mortgage early or invest? Higher safe yields in 2024 upend the old rules related to mortgage paydown. That's tomorrow, but for now, I'm Luke Guerrero, and I'm ready to take your calls at 888-99-CHART.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It is official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
No two portfolios are alike, and every investor has a unique set of circumstances. So don't forget to call InvestTalk. 888-99-CHART.
How you doing, Luke? Bill from Philadelphia here. I am calling because I'm interested in a couple of small cap ETFs, and I'm looking to see which one you think will possibly have the better performance within the next 5 to 10 years. A little bit of a longer term hold. And I'm looking at IWM, the Russell 2000, and then the CALF, the U.S. Small Cap 100 ETF, the Russell 2000, obviously more diversified. But kind of wanted to get your thoughts if you see one to potentially outperform the other within the next 5-10 years. I am looking forward to hearing your response on the show. Thanks so much, and love what you guys do.
So the question, I believe, was about RWM or CALF. And so RWM is actually a short Russell 2000 ETF. So it's not really an investment vehicle. It's a hedging vehicle. And so it returns negative whatever the Russell 2000 returns on a daily basis. So if you're looking to invest in the Russell 2000, you either, I heard the wrong ticker, or maybe you gave the wrong ticker. Either way, RWM is not the way to do it. But like you mentioned, if you are talking about the Russell 2000, the Russell 2000 is a broad market small cap ETF. It gives you market cap weighted exposure to the 2000 names that are the largest after the 1,000 names that are the even larger than that, right? The Russell 1,000 is large caps, then the next 2,000 names are small caps. So, you know, that is just a pretty broad way to get exposure to the small cap asset class, which differs from CALF. And so CALF starts with the S&P Small Cap 600 Index, screens out financial companies, the exception of REITs, and essentially weights it based on profitability, dividend yield, free cash flow yield. And so because it's starting with the S&P 600, you're actually going to end up in pretty heavily mid-caps. You're going to have about 50% mid-caps, 50% small caps, because the way the S&P 600 is constructed is by committee. They don't do a number of names, market cap, weighted approach. It's a selection, right? So you end up with things that aren't small caps. So just based on that, if you're looking for a 5 to 10 year hold and you're trying to get exposure to the small cap asset class, what you're going to want is the Russell 2000 ETF. And it's not RWM, remember, that's the inverse. That's actually the opposite of what you want. And because it's going to be a more passive approach versus this CALF, it's also going to be cheaper. CALF is about 60 basis points. So, you know, in summary, if you just want small cap exposure, Russell 2000, if you're okay with mid cap exposure and you want to tilt towards high free cash flow yield names, then that's why you would want CALF, but you're going to pay a little bit more for it. Thanks for the call. Now let's shift gears back to an interesting thing of note for markets, and that was new U.S. housing market data that was released today. And what it showed is that new family home sales really had an encouraging uptick in March. According to the Commerce Department, sales surged 8.8% to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 693,000 units, which is the highest level since September. Unfortunately, as tends to be the case these days, not all news is positive, because the median home price has now jumped to a 7-month high. Put on top of that, that mortgage rates are on the rise again, and affordability continues to be a major hurdle, especially for first-time home buyers. And so this increase is partly driven by a labor market that is robust, wages that are increasing, and a strong economy that makes it difficult for the Fed to cut rates. And so, you know, despite this uptick in sales, one of the things that was most shocking to me and really most important going forward is that new home construction is showing signs of slowing. The March data actually indicated that there were declines in both single-family housing starts and building permits. And so this exacerbates the issue down the road, right? Because if there aren't a lot of homes on the market today, because people have golden handcuffs or for whatever reason, they just don't want to move, and we aren't building homes as quickly as we need to be, then this is going to stretch the market for years to come from a buyer's perspective. So, you know, I think overall home builder sentiment remains cautious for good reason. Builders are noting that buyers are hesitant, waiting for clearer signals on where interest rates might be headed, which is understandable because even a 1 percentage point change in interest rates can drastically change the cost of a home. Now, digging deeper, regionally, the sales increases were pretty broad. All four regions of the U.S. saw some gains. And prices tell a slightly different story. The overall supply of new homes on the market at the end of March was 477,000 units, up from February's 465,000 units. And so as we look ahead, the government is really set to release its first quarter GDP figure soon. Some estimates are even suggesting the economy could have grown at a staggering 3.1% annualized rate, something that many would thought have been unthinkable a year ago. So, you know, with an economy that doesn't seem like it will relent, a labor market that continues to be strong, as well as new constructions moving, frankly, in the wrong direction, it doesn't appear to me that homebuyers will be seeing any relief anytime soon. Now, when people take the time to leave an InvestTalk podcast review on iTunes, we like to thank them for their courtesy by getting to their questions quickly. And this question is about TU, TELUS, a mid-cap Canadian telecom, which has been beaten down for the past 2 years. The dividend isn't sustainable, it appears, but do you see this company as having a potential at some level? What level? Or is it a value trap? So let's pull up TELUS here. First, we got to spell it correctly with one L. And so as the comment suggested, TELUS is a mid-cap Canadian telecom name. And, you know, it's generated about $20 billion in revenue in 2023, and its dividend may be in danger due to a history of not earning enough free cash flow to cover it. So it tends to struggle in times of higher interest rates. And, you know, Canadian growth, like I said before, is second best amongst the G7, I believe. So operating primarily in Canada is a good thing. 81% of its revenue is from Canada, 19% internationally. But that sales growth is something that has kind of stymied over the past couple of years. In 2022, it was $18 billion in revenue. In 2023, it was $20 billion. And this year, it's set to grow slightly, only by about $50 million in revenue. So, you know, telecoms are incredibly expensive. And when you cannot generate the cash flow to sustain your dividend, you're not generating enough cash flow to continue to grow your business. And that's something that's been apparent over the past couple years. So to me, yes, this dividend yield seems like a value trap sitting at 6.8%. I wouldn't be surprised if they cut it. Like I said, they haven't had enough free cash flow or a history of earning enough free cash flow to sustain that dividend over long periods of time. Now let's slip in another InvestTalk listener question now. You know the number, 888-99-CHART.
Hello, Justin, Steve, and Luke. This is Aaron from Virginia. I'm a longtime listener and also a current client with you guys. My question is in regard to artificial intelligence and how you think it will have an effect on the financial industry. So as financial advisors, what are ways that you guys are looking to utilize artificial intelligence? And will this become something to where the majority of financial advisors will rely heavily on AI instead of people? And do you think the rise of AI is a positive or a negative for the financial industry? Once again, thank you guys for your services. I'm very happy. And Steve, hang in there. I hope you're getting better. You're in our thoughts.
So that's it. That's an interesting question. And it's a slightly loaded question. So AI has for some time actually been involved within the financial services industry. And I think that's a good thing. You know, we use several tools that analyze earnings reports and mark changes in sentiment from earnings call to earnings call and various other, what some would consider AI, though really it's just language models, neural networks, something that's been involved with a lot of industries for quite some time. And so as that progresses, I think that it doesn't necessarily replace, you know, human interaction within markets, human interaction with companies. It increases efficiency. It may scale down businesses in terms of employee counts, but overall, it's just a tool that people still have to use. And I think it's a good thing because the speed at which information is incorporated into prices leads to those prices being fair representations of those assets. And the more quickly you can incorporate information, which means a computer scaling through earnings reports rather than somebody on a cell phone typing notes, is going to be more beneficial for markets as a whole. It's going to make capital easier to raise. It's going to make prices more efficient. It's going to make the market more efficient as a whole. So I think going forward, you're going to see AI being used in a lot of industries. I think finance is certainly one of them, but it's also what people consider to be AI has been used in various tools within the financial services industry for quite some time. And I don't see that trend reversing. Thanks for the call. Well, 2024 is moving fast, and we are into the second quarter and almost through April. You may have noticed that we've been telling you for a while now that a new market environment has taken hold and that serious investors need to be able to adjust their thinking and strategies to fit the times. Let me remind you that here on InvestTalk and at KPP Financial, we operate with a philosophy of independent thinking, shared success. We offer unbiased guidance and practice parallel investing, where we invest alongside our clients in investment strategies that we implement for ourselves. So I encourage you to take advantage of our offer to provide a free portfolio review assessment via telephone, Skype, or GoToMeeting. If you're interested, send us a message through investtalk.com. Hang on. Our work continues in just over 30 seconds.
Every investor is working to build a secure financial future.
Calling for your assessment of Blackstone Incorporated.
Everyone's situation is different.
Just wanted to get your opinion on JP Morgan.
And so are their questions.
Get your thoughts on CRM, Salesforce.
Each podcast is unique, and you set the agenda.
I'm wondering if now...
24/7, rain or shine, InvestTalk is made better by the power of you. 888-99-CHART.
So here's an interesting story that maybe some people don't know. And that is the US over the past decade or so has made some real strides in terms of how much oil it produces. And that's important because there's a delicate relationship between oil markets and global stability. Recently, tensions in the Middle East once again threatened to upset this delicate balance, when direct military strikes by both Iran and Israel stoked fears of a wider regional conflict. Yet curiously, oil prices have remained unusually stable. Why is that? Well, that stability is largely thanks to the U.S. shale industry, which has fundamentally transformed the global oil landscape. Over the past two decades, the U.S. has increased its petroleum production from 7 million to nearly 20 million barrels per day, effectively matching its consumption. That shift has not only decreased dependency on Middle East oil, but also allowed the U.S. to become get this, a net oil exporter for the first time in decades. The U.S. shale boom has reduced the impact of OPEC's supply cuts and allowed for more aggressive U.S. sanctions on oil suppliers like Venezuela. We talked about that yesterday and how they're shifting towards cryptocurrency. And Russia, without the fear of skyrocketing domestic oil prices. But all this aside, it doesn't mean that America is still is not vulnerable to oil shocks. Should Middle East tensions rise, a potential closure of the Strait of Hormuz could still send global prices soaring. But overall, this new era and the uncertainty around it are why the Biden administration remains cautious, aiming to avoid actions that could escalate Middle East tensions even further. Without a doubt, the U.S.'s ability to produce its own oil is a strategic advantage. It provides a buffer against global supply disruptions, but the oil market still remains global. And while the U.S. may have more control over its oil destiny than in the past, their journey towards true energy independence and stability is certainly a long, long road. Now let's try and fit in another caller question now.
Hi, I'm calling today about the silver miner ETF, SILJ. I was wondering if you guys think now is a good time to get in with the silver catching up to gold, that ratio. Let me know your thoughts. Thank you very much. Bye.
So SILJ is not just a silver miners ETF. It's the Amplify Junior Silver Miners ETF. So it is actually a small and mid-cap silver miners ETF. About 30% of it is mid-cap, 42% of it is small-cap, and 21% of it is micro-cap. So they deliver the small and mid-cap silver mining asset class at about 70 basis points, which honestly I think is maybe about 5 or 6 basis points more expensive than the Global X Silver Miners ETF, which is way more heavily weighted towards large caps. Now, this fund, which has about $1 billion in assets, it's an interesting question. I think silver is a good commodity to have an allocation to. And the way to do it, in my opinion, is through mining. We've talked about this before, rather than owning a volatile commodity. If you invest in a company whose revenues are based on that commodity, they can smooth the investment experience. When prices are down, they can cut costs and so on and so forth. But mining is also an incredibly expensive endeavor. And it's capital intensive. It requires a lot of financing. But more than that, once you discover these new mines, it takes a while to bring them online. And so in a time when interest rates are rising, it would make sense to me that you would probably want to more heavily allocate towards large cap silver mining ETFs. I know I say from time to time that small caps tend to have higher expected returns, but this is a very capital intensive business. So for me, I think this is way too heavily weighted towards small and micro caps within the silver mining business. I think the largest name is a $9 billion name. So, you know, if you wanted to allocate to silver, I'd probably just buy one or two of the large cap names, or maybe a more broad, more weighted towards a market cap weight ETF. Thanks for the call. Now, we also have another iTunes question we would like to get to, and this one about CPB. I was curious about CPB and if I should pick some shares up. It's making higher lows over the past few months, but also lower highs. So CPB is Campbell's Soup, and I don't think I need to tell you what Campbell's Soup does, but you know, I think overall, the company's profitability performance is strong. It's consistently sector beating in terms of its profits and in terms of performance over the past 5 years. But I think we'll take a deeper dive into the fundamentals and the technicals of this company when we come back for our last break. I look forward to hearing from you, hopefully, within the next 10 minutes or maybe tomorrow. Either way, you can call anytime at 888-99-CHART.
Guerrero is here and ready to tackle your questions.
I wanted to pick your brain about Apple. What did you think about their earnings call? Is this a good time to add to my position?
Call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
InvestTalk is here to help. And when you download the free InvestTalk podcasts, don't forget to rate and review. The phone lines are open, 888-99-CHART.
Now, before we headed to the break, we were answering a question about Campbell's Soup. And Campbell's Soup is probably, in my opinion, a household name because they've been making meals, beverages, and snacks since really the end of the Civil War, 1869. And so I mentioned before the break that the company's profitability performance is pretty strong. And they've been consistently, I would say, beating the rest of their sector peers over the past 5 years. They've outperformed them by about 4.8%. And so looking at their fundamentals, their debt levels are pretty modest, about $4.9 billion on a $13 billion market cap company. And so, you know, the comments suggested they're making lower highs and higher lows, I believe is what they said. High lows over the past 4 months. And that's also the case with their cash flow. Their cash flow has been steadily heading downward over the past 5 years, even as their profitability has remained stable. And because of that, their relative strength of the past 6 months, not great. Looking at this company overall, I think the thing that strikes me the most is really the lack of sales growth. They have some decent net income growth over the past 5 years, but over the past 5 years, their revenue growth is about 1.5%. And so I say it all the time, capital is your scarcest resource other than time. And I think there are other places where you could better invest your capital than a company that has been struggling to grow over the past 5 years. Now, before we head off for the night, we're going to get to an interesting development, not interesting or not unforeseen for myself or Justin, but certainly interesting for those who had a different opinion heading into the year. And that is that there is a shift in financial market expectations that could signal a change in the Federal Reserve's approach to interest rates. Recently, a once unthinkable scenario for some has started gaining traction among traders, and that is that there's a possibility that U.S. interest rates might increase within the next 12 months. And so the backdrop of this shift is a series of stronger than expected U.S. economic data prints and some hawkish comments from policymakers that have caused some to recalibrate their market forecasts. Options markets, for example, are now reflecting a roughly 1 in 5 chance, 20%, of a rate increase in the next 12 months, a sharp, sharp increase from the year before. And so this revelation comes after a period where the consensus largely anticipated rate cuts. Remember, at the start of the year, some people thought 6 or 7. Pretty absurd. Then that shifted to 3 or 4. Now, that expectation has been pared down even further, pretty significantly further, with the central expectation now being just 1 or 2 rate cuts, and when they were originally supposed to be in March, maybe by September this year. And so the change in sentiment was catalyzed by the 3 consecutive months of higher than expected U.S. inflation data, which has led some to reconsider the direction of the next rate move. Notably, Larry Summers, former U.S. Treasury Secretary, who's never shy about making his opinion known, hinted earlier this month that the next adjustment could actually be an increase. This notion is further supported by comments from industry leaders Richard Clarida, a former vice chair of the Fed and current economic advisor to PIMCO, one of the world's largest bond traders, noted that while a rate rise isn't his base case, it certainly becomes more and more of a possibility should core inflation exceed 3%. So what do we have to look forward to tell us about the path of rates? Well, this Friday's upcoming release of March's Core Personal Consumption Expenditures, or PCE, index, which is an inflation measure that is closely watched by the Fed, will be crucial in shaping those expectations. Yet still, interestingly enough, the narrative isn't one-sided. There remains a significant chance, also 20%, that the Fed could lower borrowing costs significantly in the next year. So what does that tell us? Well, to me, the fact that there's a dual possibility going on that essentially has the same chance, 20% that we raise rates, 20% that we drastically cut rates, underscores the uncertainty prevalent in markets today. People don't know. It's difficult to predict. But in sum, while the landscape at the start of 2024 looked to favor rate cuts, recent developments have opened the door for the possibility of rate hikes. This evolving scenario is a crucial one, which investors have to pay attention to, as it will influence investment strategies and economic forecasts moving forward. I'm Luke Guerrero, and this completes another InvestTalk program. We thank you for listening, and we encourage you to tell your friends and your family members about our free podcast downloads. Get yours anytime at iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify. And please be sure to rate and review us on iTunes. And if you leave us a question, we'll get to it as quickly as we can. Remember to also tell your friends that the InvestTalk podcast is now available in video format on our YouTube channel. Search InvestTalk, and don't forget, that's two T's, not one. Independent thinking, shared success. This is InvestTalk. Good night.
InvestTalk is a trademark of KPP Financial. Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for the listener to understand that not all comments made will apply to them. Specifically, nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell security. Because such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor firm which retains all rights. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. Steve Peasley is president, and Justin Klein is chief executive officer of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial. Thank you for listening, and your comments and questions are welcome on our 24-hour listener line at 888-99-CHART.